Before we start on the lecture, what I'm going to be talking about is the box there, external information. Why it's external, I'm not sure, but anyway, it's information that we get from archaeology in the land of Israel. Before we start, I want to quote the immortal words of Winnie the Pooh. You've heard of Winnie the Pooh? Yeah. Heffalumps and woozles, beware, beware. And what are things to be wary of when we study archaeology? A number of points. Number 1A. Does everyone have an outline? It's important because this will be on the finals at the end of the seminar. So that will count for 10% of your mark in the world to come. Okay. So 1A. The first problem, calm down. The first problem is jumping to conclusions based on incomplete information. Like the joke told by an Israeli archaeologist to Time magazine, who claimed, he was talking about this problem of incomplete information, and he said that according to his studies of ancient Israel, the Jews had wireless communication thousands of years ago. And he was asked by the interviewer, how could you verify that? And he said, very simple, we've dug up hundreds of ancient Israelite towns, we have not found wires in any of them. So, now clearly, that is jumping to a conclusion based on incomplete information. And indeed, beyond the joke, there are those who have done that. Kathleen Kenyon, who was the first archaeologist to have excavated the most ancient city in the world, the city of the moon, known in Hebrew as Jericho, her excavations of that city, towards the beginning of last century, she came to the conclusion that indeed the city was destroyed by an invading force. Indeed, the state of the walls seemed to indicate that the walls had collapsed. And indeed, she said this was the ancient biblical city of Jericho. However, she said obviously the biblical date for the invasion of Israel by the Jews of 1270 BCE was incorrect. Why was it incorrect? Because at the time, there was importing of a certain type of Phoenician glassware that was very common. Since Jericho was a major city, a major metropolis, one would expect to find Phoenician glassware in Jericho. She did not find it there. Why did she not find it there? She said it must be because Jericho was conquered well before the biblical date, well before it was common to import this type of Phoenician glassware. Now, what was her problem? I believe the Biblical Archaeology Review, in an article about 4 or 5 years ago, points out that Kathleen Kenyon made a number of mistakes in jumping to this conclusion. Mistake number one was that Kathleen Kenyon only excavated 2 20-by-20-foot squares in the entire city of Jericho. Now, if you would randomly excavate 2 20-by-20-foot squares in the city of Jericho and not find a certain type of pottery, would it be logical to jump to the conclusion, therefore, the pottery did not exist there? I think that would be incorrect. A. B. Further excavations of Jericho found that the place where she happened to sink the 2 20-by-20-foot squares was in the poor section of the city. And hence, you would not expect to find imported Phoenician glassware in the poor part of the city. You'd expect to find it in the wealthier part of the city. And indeed, when later archaeologists excavated Jericho, what they found was imported Phoenician glassware in the wealthy part of the city. Another example of incomplete information would be Herodian stones in the Kotel. You know what the Kotel is, the Western Wall? So if you have a look, there's a type of stone called the Herodian stone. It's got a border that looks like this. The stone has a border carved around it, which is very typical of the Herodian period. Now, if you look at the wall, the stones in the Western Wall, at least the bottom layers of stone, they have a Herodian border carved around them. Now, what could you conclude about the provenance of these stones? What could you conclude about the antiquity of these stones? Are they from Herod or earlier? What would you say? How do you know? Herod built the second temple, right? Herod renovated the second temple. Okay, so how do we know if the stone was placed? Now, you could look at that stone and say, obviously the stone was placed there by Herod. How do I know that? It's got a Herodian border. But that you don't have enough information to make that conclusion. Why not? What more information do you need? You need to know is, could you carve such a border on a stone that was already in the wall or not? Think of it logically. I know it's early, right? But if you could carve a stone, a border in a stone already in the wall, just like that, the fact that there's such a border on the stone does not mean the stone was placed there by Herod. It could have been there for 1,000 years beforehand. Herod came and carved the stone on the border, carved the border on the stone. If, however, it is impossible to carve such a border on the stone when it's already in the wall, that would appear to be fairly good evidence that the stone came from Herod. Indeed, I've discussed this with a stone cutter and a specialist in stone cutting, and he says that we can cut a border into a stone in the wall nowadays using electric equipment. But at that time, it was virtually impossible. So he says he believes that the conclusion that the stones which have those borders were put there by Herod seems to be warranted and seems to be correct. Indeed, probably put there by Herod. So you see, very often you need a lot more information than that which meets the eye. That's A. B. Judging and evaluating the past based on our own experiences and or the experiences of contemporary society and our own way of looking at things. For example, I saw an article in the Biblical Archaeology Review by I think it was Benjamin Mazar, that they uncovered a fairly extensive Philistine city in the Gaza Strip. And this Philistine city had very beautiful artwork, a very advanced water collection system, a very advanced sewerage system, and it was quite an impressive city technologically and culturally. And the archaeologist threw off a little comment there, which I thought was very interesting. He said, clearly, the biblical picture of the Philistines as uncultured is clearly contradicted by this town. You hear that? The biblical picture of the Philistines as uncultured is contradicted by this town. Now, you see, what is his mistake here? You see, if you go to the art gallery, you go to the Tate Gallery in London, right, or you go to the Billy Rose Sculpture Garden, Israel Museum, or you go to the some modern art gallery, you're standing there with a friend and you're looking at a Jackson Pollock painting, Blue Poles, let's say. And your friend looks at this and says, I don't know, my kid could do better than that. Your friend, we would describe in English as a Philistine. You, my dear fellow, are a Philistine, meaning an uncultured, ignorant boor. However, that expression appears nowhere in the Torah. The Torah does not describe the Philistines as uncultured. How does it describe the Philistines? As evil people. Now, evil and uncultured are not contradictions, or actually don't necessarily go together. You could have very fine music, Wagner. You could have very great architecture, the Reichstag. You could have very advanced technology, the V2 rocket. And you could still be a barbarian and an evil person, could you not? Unfortunately, we in our century know that is so. But the Torah never calls the Philistines uncultured. It calls the Philistines evil. And so the archaeologist who made this conclusion is taking his own usage of the word Philistine, meaning uncultured, placing it upon the Bible and saying that's what the Bible describes Philistines as, and now showing a contradiction to that. Obviously, logical error. Number 1C, another heffalump, or jagular. Right, imagining scenarios without taking probability into account. Yesterday, Rabbi Rieti spoke about the revelation at Sinai and the fact that it was clearly a momentous event happened to the Jewish people there, and we can prove that. However, archaeologists have disputed that claim and have claimed that no, the event was not necessarily true, a momentous event happened, but who says it was a revelation by God? Who says God was speaking to the Jewish people? Maybe it was something else. So what was it? So an archaeologist by the name of Garstang, he proposed this theory. He said what happened at Mount Sinai was, he calls it the magic mushroom theory. Magic mushrooms. What does that mean? He says the Jews come to Mount Sinai and they found hallucinatory mushrooms. Right? And, you know, they basically all had this giant trip. Right, and that was the revelation. Now, you've got to take probability into account when you throw out an example like that, and you say, well, probably it was magic mushrooms. Garstang is not saying, first of all, A, hallucinatory mushrooms are not found in that region of Sinai. Nueva and Eilat, yes, but not there, right? So, you know, you don't find hallucinatory mushrooms in that area. That's A. B, right, imagine this whole scenario is this is a Jewish Woodstock, right? So they all come to the mountain. All these Jews come out to Mount Sinai. They're like, they eat the magic mushrooms. They're licking their postage stamps or whatever, the back of the mezuzah, right? Yeah, and they're coming along. They're saying, all right, yeah. And then after the trip's over, they say, hey, that was wild, man. Yeah, it was really wild. Let's put on tefillin. Let's fast, right? Let's keep Shabbos, right? This is like, it's insane. In other words, he has not taken probability into account. In addition, there are those, Gus Dang was a colleague of Kathleen Kenyon, and he suggested another possibility, another possible scenario. He said maybe it was hypnotism. Moses hypnotized people. Well, first of all, here is problematic for a few reasons. A, there's no evidence of any hypnotism existing in the ancient world, in the world at all, before about the mid-19th century. None. That's A. B, how do you hypnotize millions of people? How do you hypnotize millions of people? Unless you have a rock band, unless it's really Woodstock, right? Unless you have television, how do you hypnotize millions of people? It can't be done. It's ludicrous. So again, you cannot give a scenario or an explanation of something without taking probability, likelihood of your scenario into account. D, bias and preconceived notions. There are lots of biases. I attended a lecture regarding the two Jeremiahs and the two Isaiahs, what they call in archaeology Deutero-Isaiah, the second Isaiah. And now, he said, why does this person assume that there were two Jeremiahs? Why is there an assumption there were two Jeremiahs? Anyone know? Biblical critics assume there's two Jeremiahs. Why do they assume so? Nope, the writing styles are pretty much the same all the way through. But I'll tell you why they assume it. They assume for this reason. In Jeremiah describes conditions hundreds of years apart in great detail in the book of Jeremiah. Now, the book of Jeremiah describes conditions in Israel pre-destruction and describes conditions in Israel, right, during and after destruction in very great detail, quite accurately. Now, clearly we all know that it's impossible for one person to describe details like that hundreds of years apart, ahead of his time, right? It's impossible. So there must have been two Jeremiahs. Now, what is the hidden assumption of that conclusion? That's right. The hidden assumption is there is no such thing as prophecy. I walk into a room, and you know I have biases. But my biases are fairly obvious, aren't they? I walk into a room with a yarmulke. You could probably figure, oh, he's probably an Orthodox Jew. Right? Is anyone figure that out? Okay. You know, I've got a beard, right, stuff, right? I'm probably a rabbi. That means I probably have a bias towards things like prophecy, okay? But that bias is fairly obvious. But if I tell you, look, logical deduction tells me there's two Jeremiahs, that by bias, which is there is no such thing as prophecy, that indeed is something which is a hidden bias. Now, the truth is, nowadays, we also believe there's no prophecy. Judaism, since about the beginning of Second Temple era, has been a non-profit organization, right? In most cases, not by choice. But nevertheless, right, at that time, we believed there was such a thing as prophecy. Okay. And E, like myths equals all false or borrowed. For instance, you find this very common in the literature of biblical criticism and archaeology, that if you find similar mythologies, similar stories in different cultures, what's the assumption? Oh, it was a common myth in the ancient world. But again, you know, that's not the only conclusion you could make from that. What other conclusion could you make from the fact that a certain story appears again and again in different cultures? Or they all got it from... Well, that's the first assumption. I said, what other assumption could you make? The other possibility, just as logical, is they all came from a common source, which means there was an accurate, in fact, factual story, and it found its way into different cultures in different formats. So in other words, it doesn't mean the story is not true, right? There's different assumptions and different ways of looking at things. And if you look at a thing from one way, it'll have a very different result than looking at it in a different way. So those, anyway, are some of the warnings before we study archaeology. Yes? Well, they were written at different periods of time, right? They were written by the prophet, usually the prophet, Jeremiah's case by a scribe, but in most cases they were written at the time the prophecy was given. So part of prophecy was a commandment to write it down. When were they redacted? That is to say, when were they included as part of the Bible? When was that process of saying, this is all prophecy? Torah, prophets and writings, that was at the time of the men of the Great Assembly in approximately 400 BC or so.
So are you saying that those books outside of the Bible were not written directly by God?
Of course not. They were written by the prophets. God told the prophets their prophecy, and the prophets recorded it, each one in their own style, as the Abarbanel points out in the beginning of his commentary on them. Right? Of course we don't say that. Now, two. Details. The Torah lends itself to archaeological and scientific study for a number of reasons. First of all, A, the Torah makes predictions and descriptions not of heaven and hell, but of reward and punishment on earth. And this is obviously a major contrast in most other religions. You read their texts, what you find is continual reference to the existence in the afterlife. What do people threaten you with? That's correct, burning in hell. And what do people promise you? The bosom of Abraham, as it says in Matthew, right? Or as it says in the Quran, the Huri, the wine women and the song of the world to come, right? So now exactly why is there such an emphasis on the world to come in these religions? Why the Torah, five books of Moses, doesn't mention it at all in the five books of Moses? The answer is quite simple, Rabbi Yudai Levi says, because if you are not sure about whether something will happen or not, what type of claim would be best to make? I'm sorry, what? That's right, very far in the future. As they say, if you want to lie, make sure your witnesses live very far away. As the mafia says, if you want to lie, make sure your witnesses are dead. Right? So now, if I am going to promise you reward and threaten you with punishment, my best bet is to threaten you or promise you with a reward in which the witnesses to that reward or punishment are very dead. Okay, I have no danger of someone coming back and contradicting me and saying, what do you mean? Becca said that I get this. I died last week. It was fine. I didn't give him a cent and it was okay. Which is not true, of course. You'll burn hell if you don't give me any money. But anyway, but that's not the point. So the idea is, right, that these people, that the Torah itself is a book which lends itself to investigation. It fulfills Sir Karl Popper's criterion. Sir Karl Popper was a great philosopher, English philosopher of science. And one of his theories, he was knighted for this theory. Sir Karl Popper developed the theory of what is a scientific statement. And he was saying this, a scientific statement is a statement which is falsifiable. What does that mean? It is a statement which is open to be tested. If it's not open to test, if I cannot verify or falsify it, it's not really a truth statement. It's a statement, I can make the statement, it may be true, but it's not really meaningful because it's not open to verification. The Torah, on the other hand, 3b, makes all its predictions about events, and all its descriptions are events in this world. Exile, dispersion, redemption, destruction, all these things in this world, and hence they are open to our investigation. And 2c, another thing that makes it easier, as Maimonides points out in Guide for the Perplexed, are the fact that the Torah uses lots of names and places and descriptions and times. In other words, the Torah doesn't give me ambiguous statements like, once upon a time, in a far, far away galaxy, right? There were this and this and this. No, you know, right? That type, it doesn't do that, right? The Torah doesn't say that. It says, on the first day of the 11th month, right, in the area right opposite Jericho, in the valley of Jordan, between Paran Tophel Dizahav, right, 11 days' journey from Kadesh Barnea towards Horeb via Mount Seir, right, the Jews were encamped on the other side of the Jordan just before they were going into Israel. It's type of like a little bit of an explicit description. It's not like once upon a time, right? Very explicit. That makes it easier. Okay, so those are some of the warnings. Those are some of the advantages. Now let's have a look at some of the details of the Torah, which archaeology has thrown a tremendous amount of light on it. Now, obviously, in archaeology is a science which, you know, you don't expect to dig up a wall and see written on the wall, Moses was here, 1313 BCE. Graffiti was not common at the time, right? You didn't have spray paint. You'd have to get up there with a hammer and chisel. You know, the cops had come by the time he got through halfway through the first letter. It's ridiculous, right? So you don't expect to find that stuff. So what we have is, on the whole, we have evidence, but the evidence, right, is not as explicit as Moses was here, but we'll see that sometimes it was quite interesting. First of all, 3a, the Ebla tablets, the cities of Nuzi, Mari, and Haran. What's interesting here is, in each of these places, what we find is, for instance, there was a famous Bible critic by the name of Wellhausen. Wellhausen maintained that Genesis was written at a much later stage in history than we claim. Why, he says? Because there are some historical anomalies. What's the anomalies? He says the first is that it says that the patriarchs had domesticated camels. Always talks about them having camels, domesticated camels. So Wellhausen pointed out there is no evidence of domestication of camels in that period of time. Early Bronze Age, no domestication of camels. He says, so therefore the Bible is inaccurate or written much later and reflects a reality that didn't happen in the time of Genesis. Secondly, he says, there doesn't appear to have been any type of international trade at the time. Right, it appears to have all been a barter system at that middle in the early Bronze Age. Very little mention of complicated negotiations. And also, he says, the names Abraham, Isaac, Sarah, Sarai, right, etc., are names that are not from that period of time. They're from a much later period of time. Now, with the discovery of three cities, Nuzi, Mari, and Haran, they found, in one of these cities, Nuzi, they found the Ebla tablets. The Ebla tablets, fascinating. One of the Ebla tablets is from the king of one of these cities, sent to his servants in another place, and the tablets tell his servants, here is money to buy fodder for my camels, right, to do trade with the so-and-so city. So now, as Aldous Huxley said, he says, how horrible it is to see a beautiful theory destroyed by an ugly little fact. So the ugly little fact that destroys Wellhausen's theory is this particular tablet. Because what does it say in the tablet? What do we find in the tablet? Domestication of camels. What else? Trade. International trade. Currency. Writing. In addition, in the cities of Nuzi, Mari, and Haran, we have found, according to Leah Bronner in Biblical Personalities and Archaeology, she cites this, also James K. Hoffmeyer in his book Israel in Egypt, both cite the fact that in these cities were found the names of the like Avram, Sarai, etc. Now, we're not claiming that the names found in these cities were the actual reference to the people that are referred to in the Torah. That's not what I'm claiming. What I am claiming is detailed knowledge of what names were common at that time, right? The fact that the Torah uses names which were common in the early Bronze Age tells me a very minor detail which tells you a lot. You know, if you go through history, you go through the past, let's say, 40 years, you would probably find trends in the names people give their children. You know, there were times when it was very biblical type names. You know, I remember watching as a child, right, an American television show called Daniel Boone. And I remember finding it fascinating that all the names that everyone has were things out of the Chumash. Right? And I was thinking, like, you know, the guy's wearing a strimal, the whole works, Hasidic. I thought, wow, these Americans are pretty frum. You know, I was very impressed. Right, so, but again, if you know the names of a different, like, you know, if I tell you someone's name is Moon Unit Zappa. That's Frank Zappa's daughter, right? Now, you can tell me probably the period of time someone to be called Moon Unit Zappa would be in a particular period of history, okay? If I tell you that someone's name is Snoop Doggy Dog, you would know he was not born in 1930, right? You would know this guy is someone in the 80s or 90s, right? Only in the 80s or 90s are we insane enough to have names like that, right? So, Nine Inch Nails. Yes, hello, my name is Nine Inch Nails. You know, there was a British musician by the name of Sid Vicious. Sid, I remember an interview with him on BBC. BBC is interviewing Sid Vicious. Excuse me, Mr. Vicious. May I call you Sid? Yeah. You know, call me what you want, mate. And he says, okay, Mr. Vicious, or Sid, do you really consider your music to be culture? You know, so Sid Vicious, I'll have to leave out half of what he said. He says something like, if I want a culture, mate, I'd leave my milk out overnight and have yogurt in the morning. Right? So, but in any case, so the fact that we find names that were common in the early Bronze Age are obviously an indication that the author and the milieu that the author is describing has a tremendous accuracy in very minor details. Another example of that is in Genesis, where it talks about the sale of Joseph, Genesis 37. It talks about the brothers selling Joseph. Joseph went out to his brothers. You may have seen the rock opera. This is the book. And Joseph went to see his brothers in a place called Dothan. And Dothan There's a pit there in Dotan. I did basic training in the Israeli army in a place called Dotan. And in Dotan, there is a pit near Dotan. It's right near Arabe and Shechem. Right? So there's a pit near Dotan, which the Arabs in the region call Bor Yosef, the pit of Joseph. I thought that was interesting. In any case, right, Joseph was sold, the Torah says in Genesis 37, for 20 pieces of silver. Esrim Kesef, 20 pieces of silver. Now, think about a detail like that. Why would it be necessary to mention a detail like that? You know, and obviously, not just not necessary, but it's very risky. Very risky. Imagine if I'm telling you how much I paid for... Like, does anyone here know, for instance, how much would a suit have cost in 1913 in the United States? You got the foggiest? You have no idea? We have no idea. We have no idea. Maybe. Okay. We have at home, we have the Sears catalogue from 1900. Back in Jerusalem, right? I mean, what are we doing with this? I don't know. I read weird things. So I've got the Sears catalogue from 1900. So it's got prices of things that you could never imagine how much these things cost, right? Now imagine you go back, if someone was writing the Torah in ancient Babylon and they're writing about the sale of Joseph, there's a lot of room for risk there in saying that the male slave went for 20 pieces of silver. Interesting to note, James Hoffmeyer points out that about 100 years before the apparent date of the sale of Joseph, slaves were going for 10 shekel. And in fact, about 50 to 100 years after the sale of Joseph, slaves were going for 150 shekel. But at the exact time that Joseph was sold, the sources seem to indicate the price of slaves was hovering around 20 pieces of silver. That's a very fascinating fact, a very fascinating detail, which shows me incredible accuracy of what's going on. Just another example, for instance, we are told that Abraham paid 400 shekel. What did he buy for 400 shekel? The cave of the Machpelah, the double cave in Hebron, that he bought to bury his wife Sarah. He paid 400 shekel. The Torah describes this as an exorbitant price. And in Jewish tradition, we are told that Ephron the Hittite ripped Abraham off badly. Right, 400 pieces of silver. Unbelievable sight. Now, how the heck do we know that 400 was a lot of money to pay for Hebron? Maybe it was a small amount. How do we know? Interesting, the scroll of Hammurabi, the code of Hammurabi, which was a Sumerian code of law, lists that the average annual income for a worker was 6 shekel a year. So if the average worker at the time of Abraham made 6 shekel a year, 400 shekel for a grave is a lot. Would anyone here pay 400 shekel for... I mean, it's cheaper to live. But I mean, of course, it's always cheaper to live. Anyway, but no, it's more expensive to live. It doesn't matter. Right, so let's not get into that. Right, so, but again, there's an idea that 400 shekel is an unbelievable amount of money. But again, here another detail. The Torah alludes to Abraham being ripped off. 400 shekel is supposed to be a rip-off. How do you know it's a rip-off? You know, you can't look at the consumer's report there, right? You know, what you have to do is you have to make deductions. You look at the code of Hammurabi, 6 shekel a year, average worker's wage. B, the price of slaves in Canaan, the sale of Joseph. Joseph was sold to Egypt and was a slave in Egypt. What does the Torah describe about Joseph? It says that Joseph was lifted up out of the pit where he was placed in Egypt in the prison. He was shaved. He was given clean garments. And when he was given the title of Tzafnat Fa'aneach, a title found in Egyptian stele, right? In addition, he was placed, a medallion was placed and a ring on his neck. We find also in Egyptian culture that one of the signs of leadership was medallion, one of the signs of leadership was the ring, and he was paraded around Egypt in a chariot. That's very, very fitting, because you see, according to most archaeologists, the Hyksos had invaded Egypt just prior to this. Now the Hyksos, who were the Hyksos? They were shepherd kings from Canaan. And the reason they were able to invade Egypt was because they had superior technology. What technology did they have? Chariots. So now, what would be appropriate after throwing out the Hyksos? How would you parade around? And the Egyptians got chariots as well after that. And of course, parading Joseph around Egypt in a chariot would be a symbol of power. Like, you remember those parades used to have in Red Square? Okay, you know, the parading around the Tu-52 tanks, etc. That's a parade of power. Right, so that's the same idea here, parading around in the chariot. Tzafnat Paneach is a title found in Egyptian literature. And also we know from the Egyptian Book of the Dead and other sources, the Egyptians placed a tremendous tremendous value on dreams and dream interpretation. And so the fact that Joseph interprets dreams and is able to get to a position of great power in Egypt is not something which is surprising at all. We have also, for instance, another couple of features about Egypt. You know, the Torah tells us that the Jews were hated in Egypt. Why were the Jews hated by the Egyptians from the very moment they came into Egypt? Why did they hate us? So the Torah tells us because the Jews were shepherds. Now, why would you hate a shepherd? I mean, shepherds are gentle folk. I mean, what do shepherds do wrong, for heaven's sakes? Why would you hate a shepherd? The answer our commentaries give us, Ibn Ezra, Nachmanides, and others, the answer the commentaries give is the Egyptians worshipped a god which was, they believe, was incarnated into a sheep. Now imagine, if you were to go to India today. Now the Hindus, many Hindus in India believe that their gods are incarnated into
a cow.
So now, supposing you visit India, and the head of the Hindu temple in Mumbai comes to you and says, "Excuse me, sir, what is your profession?" Say, "My name is Ronald McDonald." And say, "Oh, very interesting. And what do you do for a profession?" "I slaughter millions of cows every day and feed them to overweight American children." Right? So now, do you think the Hindus would like you?
No.
How popular would you be in Hindu culture? Not very. Okay. The Jews in Egypt were in the same situation. Here, this handsome fellow at the top here, this is the ram god Khnum, god of the first cataract of the Nile, worshipped by the Egyptians. In fact, later on, he became one of the major gods of the Egyptians. But the ram god Khnum, there are still, in a place called Karnak in Egypt, there are still monuments to Khnum, which are actual sheep. And these monuments are things the Egyptians used to worship. So now, why would the Egyptians hate shepherds? Because the shepherds, there are two reasons here. A, look what they're doing to God, right? And B, right, the shepherd knows that, guess what? It's only a sheep. This, of course, gives us some insight. Ram God Khnum gives us fascinating insight into a mitzvah of the Torah. The Torah gives us a mitzvah. It tells the Jews, what are they supposed to do before getting out of Egypt? Slaughter a paschal lamb. The Jews are supposed to take a sheep, put it on a spit whole, roast it whole, and eat it in a large family group, okay, and not break the bones afterwards. So the Zohar says, you know why? This is, I'll use an American expression, the Jews' intent here was to diss the Egyptians. Is that the correct expression?
Yes.
Here they are in the hood of Khnum, in Khnum's hood. Right, Khnum is the man, and the Jews are dissing the man. Okay, so therefore, I assume all Americans can understand this. Okay, now, therefore, what we did with the Paschal Lamb was an act of tremendous courage, and an act of breaking with idol worship, which was an amazing thing. Here, the Jews are courage. Imagine doing that in India. The Untouchables in India would take a cow, put it on a spit, roast it whole. They'd be slaughtered to the man. Here, the Jews roast Khnum on a spit, and the Egyptians come in and say, "What is that?" And the Jews say, "That is a lamb." And they go, "Oh my God, what is it?" And the Jews are like, "God burgers." Right? And this is not something which the Egyptians appreciated. So now, underneath that you have, of course, this is quite famous. This is from the 2nd century BCE. But it's a stele, that means an Egyptian inscription on stone, of a 7-year period of famine. And it tells us a fascinating thing. Obviously, this is not the same period as we believe that it happened in the Torah, but it could be there were different periods of 7-year famines. What is interesting, though, here, it says that it records how Pharaoh took everyone's land, except there was one group whose land he did not take. Who was that? No, the priests. Where do we find a similar aspect, a similar similarity to that? In the story of Joseph, when there was a famine in Egypt, again 7 years, but hundreds of years earlier, Joseph had all the Egyptians sell their land so that he could give them food. Except one group did not have to sell their land. Who were they? The priests. The priests of the Egyptians didn't sell their land. The priests of Ra. Ra, the sun god. Potipharah, the mouthpiece of Ra. Right, he was one of the Egyptian priests. What's interesting also, the first plague to hit the Egyptians is the plague on the Nile. The Nile turns to blood. Why is that significant? Because the Egyptians believed that one of their gods, was actually every time the Nile overflowed or inundated its banks, they believed that was a resurrection of their god. And every time the god was resurrected, the Nile would overflow and irrigate the land of Egypt. Now, what is the fascinating symbolism of the first plague? What happens is the Nile overflows, and what does the water turn to? Blood. What does that tell you about what happened to their god? If you're an Egyptian, what would you see in that? Nietzsche, God is dead, you'd say. Right? Because you'd see blood. Right? Horrific. Each one of the plagues hit a different component of Egyptian society and culture. Now, in regards to the plagues themselves, there's very interesting because there was a... There is a papyrus known as the Ipuwer papyrus, written by an Egyptian priest by the name of Ipuwer. It is otherwise known as the Leyden 344. Leyden is the museum in Holland where the papyrus exists. Now, this particular papyrus is fascinating. I'll tell you why. Because the papyrus is from a period in Egyptian history from the time of a pharaoh by the name of Pepi. P-E-P-I. Pepsi without the S. Now, this Egyptian pharaoh is described in a very fascinating way. In fact, according to the Egyptian historian Manetho, he describes this pharaoh as living to the age from the age of six, ruling from the age of six to the age of 100, which was quite surprising. Most kings did not rule that long, and it's very, very rare to have anyone living that age in those times. So it's quite unique. One pharaoh who ruled for close to 100 years, and his name was Pepi. Now, what's also interesting is that there is a Midrash Rabbah. This is also in the Turin Royal Canon, which says that he ruled over 90 years, and the epitome of Manetho, right, indicates he began to rule at the age of 6. Now, what's interesting here is that there is a Midrash Rabbah, right, in Exodus, which says that the Pharaoh of the Exodus ruled for 94 years. Now, that's quite an amazing coincidence. You've got a Pharaoh Pepi that according to Manetho ruled for 94 years, and the Midrash Rabbah says the Pharaoh of the Exodus ruled for 94 years. From the period of the Pharaoh Pepi, we have this papyrus. Now, I've got on the left side here, I've got the section from the papyrus. On the right-hand side, I have verses from the Torah in Exodus. If you have a look at the beginning of that, what you'll find is you don't need a degree in archaeology to look at it, to read this here. I mean, check this out. The plague is throughout the land, right? Blood is everywhere. The river is blood. Men shrink from tasting. Human beings and thirst after water. You look at the Torah in Exodus, describes the plague of the Nile. On the left, forsooth. Forsooth is the Old English word for oy vey. Oy vey. Gates, columns and walls are consumed by fire. Lower Egypt weeps. The entire palace is without revenues. Right, grain has perished on every side. Look at the Exodus. We talk about the plague which destroyed the crops, which was fire, which was ice, which was the plague of hail. On the left, animals weep, cattle moan. Cattle are left astray, plague on the cattle. 9-11 in the scroll, in the Ipuwer papyrus, the land is without light. In Exodus 10-22, darkness in the land. 4-3 seems to be describing a terrible event. Children of priests are dashed against the walls. Children of princes are cast in the streets. Even in the prison is ruined. He who places his brother in the ground is everywhere, meaning people who bury their brother are all over Egypt. There is groaning throughout the land. Look at the description of the plague of the firstborn in Exodus. By midnight the Lord smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh and his throne, the princes, to the firstborn of the captives in the prison. The prison was in ruins. And finally, penultimately, right? Behold, the fire was mounted up on high. Its burning goes forth against the enemies. The Egyptians see the Jews going out of Egypt with a pillar of fire. And in the end, it tells us in the Torah that when the Jews left Egypt, what did they ask of the Egyptians? They requested from the Egyptians silver and gold articles and clothing, jewelry. And the Egyptians granted their request. And it says the Israelites drained Egypt of its wealth. What does Ipuwer lament? Gold and lapis lazuli. Silver and malachite, carnelian and bronze are fastened on the neck of female slaves. Now, what's interesting here is there are many archaeologists, I have to be honest, many, many archaeologists say this is pure mythology. They relegate Ipuwer papyrus to the mythology literature of Egypt. It's fiction, just like nowadays. There's, you know, if some archaeologist in 1,000 years would dig up Tom Clancy, right? Would he say, oh, yeah, well, this must have happened? No, this is fictional literature from Egypt. But you see, it depends on the paradigm. Because their assumption is that everything in the Torah is mythology, if I find something that corroborates the Torah, what do I say? Another piece of fascinating mythology. If your assumption is the Torah is actually a historical document, when I find this, what do I say? Corroboration. So it depends on your point of view, but certainly the Egyptologists that maintain this is fiction literature, they put it into fiction literature because they have a prior assumption, a minimalist reading of the Torah, which is that what we're reading here is mythology. In addition, here's another piece in the Torah, which I found this may not impress you because it's not that well known. But, you know, in the Torah, if you look in Bamidbar, in Numbers, it talks about a man called Bilam. Anyone know who Bilam was? All right, let me read to you about Bilam. Bilam was a pagan priest. He was a pagan priest who was a person hired to curse the Jews. Let me read you this. The account of Bilam, son of Beor, who was a seer of the gods. The gods came to him in the night and he saw a vision. And he was an oracle of El. And this is what Bilam, son of Beor, said. Now, what's interesting is I was not reading from the Torah just now. I was reading from the De'er Allah text, which was a text, this is quoted in the Biblical Archaeologist magazine in 1986, which was a plaster inscription, which is in the Amman Museum in Jordan, from Tel De'er Allah. In Tel De'er Allah, right, there's an inscription that talks about a fellow by the name of Bilam, son of Beor, who was a seer of the gods, who was recognized as a prophet and a seer, right, and a visionary, who used to get prophecies from a god called El, E-L. Now, that's almost word for word a description of Bilam in the Torah, in Numbers 24, where it says, utterance of Bilam, son of Beor, seer, Chose, a seer, right, who received prophecies from Kel, from El, from God, E-L. And literal, word for word. Now, we go a little further here. I'm skipping some because we don't have time. The mysterious MBI people. People often ask me, if the Jews were in the Sinai Desert for 40 years, where is the evidence of their having lived there? Where is the evidence of their having lived there? So first of all, one has to ask yourself, what evidence should there be? What do the Jews live in? Tents or Sukkot or nothing, clouds, right? So what evidence exactly, you know, 3,000 years later in the Sinai Desert, you expect to find tents intact? Sukkahs? Palm frond? How long does your sukkah last, for heaven's sakes? My sukkah barely lasts for 7 days, right? But the Jews did stay somewhere for over 15 years. Where did they stay for about 15 years? Anyone know? Rashi tells us the Jews lived in one place, in the desert. Kadesh Barnea. Now, what's interesting is, Biblical Archaeology Review talks about a people called the mysterious MBI people. MBI stands for Middle-Late Bronze Age Interchange Period, which was the period of the Exodus. MBI people. Now, here are some of the features of the MBI people that the Biblical Archaeology Review lists. First of all, it says, these people appeared suddenly in the Sinai Desert and dwelt in Kadesh Barnea, because there's evidence of dwellings from about 3,000 years ago in Kadesh Barnea in the northern Sinai. These people invaded Israel, invaded Canaan from the Jordan area, from Moab, north of the Dead Sea. These people found, together with remains of these people in Kadesh Barnea, were found Egyptian decorations and ornaments called scarabs, little Egyptian beetle ornaments. Right, now, the mystery is, who are these people? If you assume the Bible is mythology, then you have the mysterious MBI people. If one assumes that the Torah is a historical document, who are the MBI people? Moi. Right? They are us. Right? We have seen the MBI people and they are we. Right? That is to say, the MBI people, the Torah tells us, appeared suddenly, because you'd expect them to appear suddenly. Just by the way, one thing I forgot to mention about Ippur, is immediately after the reign of this pharaoh Pepi, Egypt went into a major economic decline for 100 years. Now, that's also interesting. Why is that interesting? I mean, what the heck? If 10 plagues were hit New York, do you think America would go into economic decline for a couple of years? I would imagine. Maybe it'd be good. I don't know. Whatever. But I mean, there's obviously, you get 10 plays going on to a major decline. But again, we have detail upon detail.
They also lost their slave labor. That's a big economic base.
That's also correct. Yes, thank you very much. That's true as well. Now, in addition, right, let's get to G. The walls of Jericho and the bar of Jericho. I don't mean by the bar of Jericho, a place like this here next door. Right, what I mean by the bar of Jericho, Biblical Archaeology Review points out what was in fact discovered at Jericho. What are the features we find at Jericho? First of all, we find that the walls actually collapsed, which is attributed to an earthquake, because Jericho is on what rift? Not the San Andreas. That's my first clue. Right, it's on the Syrian Rift. Right, there's a series called the Syrian Rift. It's actually Sfat, the city of Safed, experienced 5 earthquakes in recorded history. As a result of that, Jerusalem, we've had earthquakes. We had an earthquake about 2 years ago in Jerusalem, minor, but it was an earthquake, right? And Jericho has experienced it, so they say, okay, the walls fell. So that's number one, walls fell. What else do we find in Jericho? That the grain stores were intact. What does that tell me about the length of the siege? The grain stores, if the grain stores were intact, right, that means if it was a long siege, how much food would you expect to find in Jericho?
None.
Not a heck of a lot. Right, if the grain stores are intact, that shows it was a very short siege. In addition, archaeologists found, strangely enough, even though Jericho was a conquered city, archaeologists found a lot of jewellery and expensive pottery in Jericho. Now, isn't that strange? Because generally, if people invaded a city, what would they do? They'd pillage the place. You would steal everything you can. Okay, so why would it not be true of Jericho? Anyone know?
Because they were in such a hurry to leave.
Nope. Nope.
Joshua told him not to touch anything.
Correct. Joshua, in the book of Joshua, it says that the Jews made a ban of excommunication because this was the first city they conquered with the help of God. They said, we will not pillage the city. We declare everything in the city to be banned and we will not take from it. One person by the name of Achan transgressed the ban, but of course you'd expect to find things still in the city because of the fact the Jews did not pillage the city of Jericho. H, the first and second temples. A lot of information about the first and second temples we find before we get to the first and second temples. When the Jews came into Israel, over here, figure 11 on the left, right, that is a stele from an Egyptian pharaoh by the name of Merneptah. That was written in about 1220 BCE. According to Jewish history, the Jews came into Israel in approximately 50 years before that. Now, that Merneptah stele, quite famous in archaeology, is the very first time that the name Israel is mentioned. Very interesting. Merneptah says he invaded the Canaan and he conquered Israel, meaning Israel was a nation which he claims to have conquered, which is fascinating because we know that there are a lot of wars that Joshua had to fight in the first period in which the Jews were settled in Israel. They fought against Canaanites, Egyptians, Philistines, etc. And what's interesting is, before that time, you find no mention of them, which is logical. Because we were slaves in Egypt, we were living in the Sinai Desert, we suddenly appear on the scene and invade Israel. The first mention is 50 years after we invade Israel, the Merneptah stele says, Israel. Below that, you'll find some other, on the left, here is the clay tablet, which is in Babylon cuneiform, which describes the destruction of the first temple by the Babylonians. It mentions that the temple was destroyed in the Babylonian month of Av. Ever heard of that? Av? No, the Jewish month Av is actually a Babylonian name. All the names of the Jewish months that we have today are Babylonian names. And in fact, the ninth of Av, the month of destruction, when the first temple was destroyed, when the second temple was destroyed, when the city of Beitar was destroyed, when the temple site was ploughed over, when the Jews were expelled from England in the 13th century, when we were expelled from Spain in the 15th century, when the First Crusade started, when the First World War was declared, Britain declared war on Germany, all these on the 9th of Av. One of the earliest events on that 9th of Av that we have in Jewish tradition is there in the Babylonian cuneiform inscription, the destruction of the temple on the 9th of Av. Below that, you've got a hexagonal inscription by Sancheriv. Who was Sancheriv? Anyone know who Sancheriv was? Bottom left. Sancheriv was the Assyrian king who invaded Israel. When he invaded Israel, he was the one who exiled the 10 tribes from Israel. Except he did not conquer the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom, what happened when Sennacherib came to the southern kingdom? Hezekiah was the king of Jerusalem. The Assyrian army had cut like a knife through butter through the whole northern kingdom, and he basically encircled Jerusalem. We are told that Sennacherib comes to the city of Jerusalem. He comes in the morning of the 14th of Nisan. That's the eve of Passover. The Jews have built a wall around the city. Hizkiah did two building projects, both of which still exist. One was, anyone know what the two things Hizkiah built? Hizkiah's tunnel, which was to get water from outside. So you can still go through. My kids have gone through Hizkiah's tunnel. In the middle of Hizkiah's tunnel, there's a stone there that says, built by Hizkiah, at the command of Hizkiah. Of course, that stone is not in the Israeli tunnel. That stone is in the Istanbul Archaeology Museum. It was taken by the Turks when they controlled Israel. But that tunnel is the tunnel of Hizkiah. Hizkiah also built a wall around Jerusalem called the Broad Wall. If you go to the old city of Jerusalem, you can see a remnant of the wall. It's 8 meters high, and it's about 3-4 meters wide. So Hizkiah built this wall. Assyrian army consisted of over 180,000 officers. We're talking about a massive army, 180,000 officers. And they come to Jerusalem, and Sennacherib sees Jerusalem in the distance, and he says, "That's it? That's what everyone talks about, Jerusalem, the big deal? Oh, give me a break." He says, "I'll tell you what, folks." He says to his army, "We'll rest tonight. In the morning, when we're feeling better, right, we will attack the city, we'll destroy it utterly." Full of confidence. "We'll destroy the city in the morning." What happened? That night, on Pesach night, the Jews are sitting there eating Seder, doing the Seder in the city of Jerusalem, behind Hizkiah's broad wall, using water from Hizkiah's tunnel. And the Assyrian army is camped around them that night. The Torah tells us in the book of Kings that all the officers in the Syrian army dropped dead. And what happened to the rest of the Syrian army? They went wacko. They went nuts. They fled, dropping weapons this way and that. They fled. Now, what's interesting is this inscription, figure 26, is an inscription by Sennacherib, a boast of his conquest of Israel. And it ends by saying, "I locked up Hezekiah in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage." And that's the end of his boast. Why is that fascinating? What's interesting about how he ends it? He doesn't say what happened. He locks up Hezekiah in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. Excuse me, Sennacherib. What happened after that? I prefer not to talk about it. Obviously he preferred not to talk about it. Because 180,000 of his officers dropped dead. The rest of his army ran away like Girl Scouts. Oh, sorry, that's a sexist remark. Like Boy Scouts, right? So they all run away, right? And bingo, right? Sennacherib doesn't record anything else. So, of course, that's because what happened was so embarrassing he would never record it. Now, if you look on the right, a little bit of background to the Hasmoneans. The Greeks, we are told in the Mishnah in Midot, the Greeks made 13 breaches in the wall of the temple. And there was a particular wall in the temple. That's a Greek inscription which says, up to here Gentiles can go. Gentiles may not go into this part of the temple. Now, how do you think the Greeks felt about that?
They didn't like it.
That's correct, right? And that would be an understatement of the century, right? But indeed, this is a Greek inscription from that period. Underneath, anyone been to Jerusalem for Shabbat? Anyone spent Sabbath in Jerusalem? What happens about 40 minutes before Sabbath, before camp, before the nightfall? A siren goes off, right? Siren, the air raid siren. Air raid sirens, just for those who do go to Israel, go up and down. I was there for the Gulf War, they go up and down. But if it's just the regular Sabbath siren, it's just a straight thing. Now, what's the origin of that siren? Because we are told that in the temple in Jerusalem, a Kohen used to go up on the wall and blow a trumpet to tell people that Sabbath is approaching, close your stores, turn off your notebook computers, right? Shut down the business, it's time to light candles. Interesting, recently was found in the southern excavations of the temple, right, was found something which says, if you can read the bottom right-hand corner, right, what it says is, anyone read that? Lebeit hatakiah, that means the place of tekiah, blowing, lehachriz, which means to announce or to proclaim. Very, very amazing. You know, we find in every single detail the Mishnah mentions about the temple, again and again we find confirmation. Just here, I don't have a projection of this, but there's a house in the old city of Jerusalem from the period of the destruction of the first temple. And it is that means the time of Jeremiah the prophet. They found two seals in that house. You know, not seals meaning clay seals. Seals don't usually last that long, right? So Canadians kill them first. So now you've got these two clay seals. That's right. You've got these two clay seals, and the clay seals from this house, from the time of destruction of the first temple, Jeremiah period, the clay seals say, it says the following, the seal of Baruch ben Neria HaSofer, Baruch ben Neria the scribe. Now, why do I find that interesting? Because anyone who's read the book of Jeremiah will know that Jeremiah didn't write down his own prophecies. Who did he tell them to? Baruch ben Neria the scribe. So here we have two clay seals, right, from the Munster collection in London, two clay seals from a house from the period of destruction of the first temple, Jeremiah period, which say on them the seal of Baruch ben Neria the scribe. We'll end with Yigal Yadin's surprise bath at Masada. That's really a bit of archaeological evidence of the oral law. Yigal Yadin, the famous Israeli archaeologist who first uncovered Masada, you know, when he went up to Masada, what he found was, he found a bath. And the bath had three pools in it. And the pools looked like this. They're still there. One pool looked like that. Another pool looked like that. There's a hole there, and the channel's cut into the stone into that pool. You understand? Three pools. One with stairs, one with a small pool, and a hole in between the wall of those two pools, and a stone channel into that pool. So Yigal Yadin looks at this and he says, hey, cool! It's a mikveh! Right, now a mikveh is built according to very strict rules. All the written Torah says about a mikveh is the following. However, ma'ayan ubor mikveh ma'im yetahor. A pit, a collection of water, and a spring shall be pure. Nothing else. All the rules of the mikveh are from the oral tradition. What's interesting is, this is constructed exactly like a modern-day mikveh. There is a place to wash before going in. There's stairs to go into the bathing pool. But we require that the water in the mikveh be fresh, be rainwater. But there's not that much rain in Israel, right? Especially on Masada. So you collect the rain by running it through stone channels into this, called the otzer, the collection of rain. And there was a hole in the wall between the two. You drain this mikveh, fill it up with fresh water, unplug the hole, the waters would kiss. When the water kisses, all the water is now considered pure mikveh water. They close up the hole again, right? Oh, sorry, that's opening it. Right, they close up the hole again, then you'd immerse in the mikveh. Yigal Yadin invited some mikveh experts from Jerusalem. It was in the newspapers in Israel. He writes about this in his book, Masada. These rabbis schlep up to Masada. They go into the mikveh, they're measuring it, tape measures, code of Jewish law. Judging it based on the 17th century code of Jewish law, the rabbis say this mikveh is a kosher mikveh. And Yigal Yadin says he was shocked. Why was he shocked? Because his paradigm was the oral law, the Torah, is not so mythology, things created different periods. Here he finds something built 400 years before the Mishnah was written down, in exact confirmation, exact concordance with the laws of the Code of Jewish Law written in the 17th century, and bingo, it's a kosher mikveh. That was the surprise bath for Yigal Yadin. And that's what it's like throughout history. Jews, throughout history, we live in Israel. My family, my kids are intimately associated with all the various archaeological sites because we go on hikes with Or Sameach all the time. I take them out of school to do that because I think they learn more at these hikes than they do at school. Right? And so we go in these places. You know, and let's tell you one incident. We went to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, the archaeological museum, and there's a pair of tefillin there from Qumran, which are 1,700 years old. Now, I just bought my son's tefillin for his bar mitzvah, which is about the same amount of dollars. And anyway, we're walking in the museum. I say to him, hey, Avram Shimon, look at this. Cool, huh? He says, what? I say, tefillin. He says, duh. Right? I said, look. I said, they are tefillin which are 1,700 years old. And he says, yes, sir. In other words, but I thought that was amazing. They are so familiar to him. Imagine taking a child from any society, showing him an artifact from 1,700 years ago, and his expression would be, well, duh, I know what that is, it's obvious. More than that, my other son, Pinchas, right, climbs up and looks at the Dead Sea Scrolls, the scroll of Isaiah, and he starts reading it, and he says to me, hey, cool, I'm learning this at school. That's miraculous. A, he remembered he's doing it at school. That in itself is, for my kid, that's a miracle. But again, but beyond that, here is an 11-year-old child living in the 20th century, fluent with computers, right? He goes to judo class, right? He does all the standard things that kids do, right? And he's reading the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he understands it. He understands the context and the subtext and the vocabulary and the commandments and the cultural milieu and the whole works. Right? It's totally familiar to him. We have a direct tradition that is so familiar that a 10-year-old boy in Jerusalem can read a 2,200-year-old manuscript written in Qumran. Right? Why? Because he's still living those same ideals. We still have this connection. That's anyway some of the idea. We can look into the grounds. And the truth, as it says in Psalms, truth can spring from the ground. In the case of archaeology, it certainly does so. Hopefully this has opened up a little bit of the field to you, and you'll do further investigation yourself. Thank you.